You're listening to the public feed of Carefree Highway Revisited, which includes only a portion of this conversation. To hear the complete discussion, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or see the show notes for details.
The first guest of the evening is truly a poet. He's an artist. He is a friend and an inspiration to anyone who I think who has ever played the guitar or tried to write poetry. Would you please welcome Gordon Lightfoot?
We have been captured by the thieves of the night, held for ransom, if you please. Heaven help the devil. May he have a few unpleasant memories. This is Carefree Highway Revisited, the show that celebrates the work of Gordon Lightfoot song by song, a proud member of the FM Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mike Messner, and along with me today, making his debut on Carefree Highway Revisited, is a fellow Lightfoot fan from Spokane, Washington, Derek Buckley. Derek, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. Honored to be here and happy to interact directly and indirectly with any Lightfoot fans.
All right. Well, the pleasure is mine. How did you originally get into Gordon's music?
Well, to start off, I was born in 1965, so my life is basically the same as his solo discography. As a kid, I always remember, if you could read my mind, Sundown and Carefree Highway were always songs that existed, sure. Not new, but they'd always been around. I have a brother that's 4 years older than me. He really got into The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald and just loved that song. I remember it being new. He got the 45 and just loved it. So that was kind of another one of the Lightfoot content. And then about 4 years later, we have an older brother who at the time by 1980 was out of the house and worked at a record store. And he pinged my other brother and said, hey, there's this new Gordon Lightfoot album coming out that's supposed to be really good. Do you want one? And so he got one and it was Dream Street Rose. And so then he and I listened to that all summer, the whole year, you know, just kind of were consumed with it. So it was about then I decided that was the style of music I really liked and was what I wanted. And then we saw him later that year in November. We had a neighbor next door. It was a pretty young couple. They were probably closer to our age than to my parents' age. So we got along with them really well. And he had the album of Sundown. So we'd borrow that and listen to it. And that fall, I just started buying up the albums I could. I started with Endless Wire and got Gorge Gold and rode those two for a while. And then throughout high school, accumulated all the others and even got cut down versions of the original United Artists, the original five of those. But then between going to San Francisco to see my aunt and uncle, and then I went to college in Seattle for a couple of years, throughout the used record stores, I was able to find the original full uncut versions. So by the time I was an official adult, I had all of his material and it's been my favorite ever since.
That's fantastic. And you're speaking my kind of language because this is very similar to the experience I had growing up with him and hearing him around the house and things. What draws you or drew you to Lightfoot's music generally?
Mainly, I would have to say the lyrics. I mean, I think the stuff he writes is all on a level above the vast majority of what's out there. It's all brilliant. It's meaningful. The melodies are each pretty unique and they always fit right in with both the feeling and the message and lyrics of the song.
A lot of my listeners and a lot of people I've had on the show really say that it is the lyrics that appeal to them. And the fact that he's so more musically advanced than a lot of his contemporaries. I mean, this is a guy who actually knows music theory as opposed to just somebody who can make up a tune and hopefully remembers it by the time they get to the studio. So that makes him unique in the pantheon, I guess. You mentioned seeing him in, I think you said it was 1980.
That was the first time, yeah.
That was the first. So first of how many?
In person, I've seen him 11 times. A few years ago, I think right when COVID was starting to crest and there was a vaccine in sight or shortly after, he actually did a live stream and I paid for that and got to watch it. So I consider that an additional time, but 11 real concerts in the one live stream.
So of all the times that you saw him live, was there a particular performance out of those 11 that really stands out?
Yeah, we'll do both ends of that. I got to thinking, I saw him 8 times in the 20th century and I guess 3 times in this century. In 2009, I went to see him, and it had been probably, I think, 12 years since we'd seen him. And I remember kind of curious as to how that one would be. And his voice had degraded a little bit over the intervening years. But I just remember that just being such a solid professional show. That one just stands out probably as one of the best, just because it was really tight. The band was good and he was great. And, you know, there were other ones when I've seen him that many times, you know, there's a lot of other times I remember leaving the shows thinking, you know, that wasn't as good as some of the previous ones, or, you know, that one was really good, you know, a really good solid one. So, which most of them were. Mm-hmm. That one I would probably say would be the best. The final time I saw him in 2017 was really good too. But, you know, there's a little bit of just a couple of little things. I mean, didn't bother me at all. It's just, he's human. The guys are human. You know, sometimes things don't just completely click, but overall it was still a great show. The second time I ever saw him though, in 1981, was kind of when he was at not the heights, but the depths of some of his personal problems. It was his birthday. He was obviously had been hitting the bottle a little bit before the show, and it was just not a great show. Started out the entire first half. He had already recorded Shadows, but it hadn't come out. So he just walked out, sat on a stool, and which, funny, the concert the year before, he said he'd never use stools. You need to be a man and stand up. So oh, okay. He sat on the stool and said, oh, I've got a new album coming out and we're going to do the whole thing for you. So, which we didn't know. So it kind of took some of the fun out of the first half of the concert. And then the second half, he did a lot of favorites, some of the ones we knew, but towards the end, they were, you know, you could tell they weren't tight at all. It was really affecting him. So, which was too bad, but had a reputation here for years for a very poor performance at a concert, but he'd been back a number of times since and made up for it.
Well, good for him. And yeah, the comparisons are inevitable between different gigs that you've seen him at. And the one that you're talking about, which was kind of the nadir of his public performance life, it's completely understandable why that would stand out in a negative way. Let's talk a little bit about the venues that you've seen him in. And now, I have never been to Spokane, so I don't know what the venues are like, except probably in Seattle. There are a number of them. But where did you see him perform?
9 of the 11 times I saw him was in the Spokane Opera House, which was originally built for the World's Fair in 1974. I think it's just under 3,000. I think it's 2,700. First time we saw him, he even mentioned that he really liked that facility. He called it a hall. He said, I really love your hall here. He goes, it was constructed for your World's Fair 6 years ago. And he goes, I was always honored because I was one of the first people they lined up to perform here. And so, yeah, it's a gorgeous facility. We still go to a lot of things there. The last time we saw him in 2017, he was at the Fox Theater downtown, which is been converted into a gorgeous performance area. It's probably 2,000, give or take, seating capacity. That one was really good. And one time we did a road trip to Yakima, Washington, which is probably about 3 or 4 hours from Spokane. We actually seen him a year or two prior, but he was there. And we thought, well, you know, that's a drive we can do without having to spend the night. So we drove over and saw him there. And that was a really good, I remember that being one of the better shows. I remember leaving there thinking, man, he hit it out of the park.
That's great. The intimacy of the places that you're talking about really make perfect sense for Gordon, because he was never a stadium guy. I mean, this is somebody who really needs the intimacy of, as he said, as you said, a small hall,
right,
to really communicate with smaller venues. Did you ever get a chance to meet the man?
I did not. A lot of the times I saw him, I was fairly young. I never thought, I was never the kind of, you know, want to stand outside the stage room door outside and wait for him, things like that. Although, there were a few shows where we kind of had some interaction, because we always would know that the concerts were coming up and jump on it to get tickets. And for the vast majority of the time, we were in the first few rows. So I had noted a couple examples of those. One of the times after the really bad show, he stopped and kind of did this little apology. And I think we were right center of the first or second row. And he said, you know, and that joke I told wasn't really that, well, that wasn't appropriate. And well, he told a few jokes. So I said, well, which one was that? And he just kind of looked at me like, you know, thanks a lot, put me on the spot. And another time he had mentioned in 1970, our Spokane hockey team, the Jets at the time, they played for the Allen Cup, which was the trophy for that league. And they played Orillia, Ontario here in Spokane. And he had mentioned that one time. And I gave him a little ribbing that we had won, but it was still a good game. And then one other time, and it was kind of really made me feel good. It was after East of Midnight when he hadn't done any albums in a while and the future was kind of uncertain. And he said he was going to do some songs. And, you know, he said he'd been working on some new stuff, but nothing had really was really gelling. And he said, well, you know, he said, I'm not saying I won't ever do an album, but if I do, and he just kind of paused looking for the words. And I just said, well, you got to do it right. And he goes, yes, exactly. You've got to do it right. And that ended up getting quoted in the paper the next day. They said he said it. It's like, well, okay, I'm not going to complain. My thought that he repeated got quoted in the paper. So I was fine with that. But as far as actually meeting him, shaking hands or talking one-to-one, I never got the chance to, sadly.
So your relationship is kind of from the peanut gallery with him.
Kind of, yeah. But I felt an underlying respect there on all of them, you know, the response. It was fun.
No, that makes perfect sense. I certainly wasn't implying that you were heckling him.
No, I know.
So today we're talking about Heaven Help the Devil from the Shadows album. And I wanted to know why you wanted to talk about that one in particular today. I'll talk about it first, which is that it seems like he is making some pretty sweeping statements. This is not a particularly personal song. He only uses the personal pronoun one time. So it's a sweeping song, but it's also one where I think he's talking about a certain kind of patriotism, talking about dying for freedom, which is something that is very big in the Western tradition. That was the reason why it kind of caught my ear. So, Derek, why did you in particular want to talk about that song today?
Well, I actually labored pretty hard on picking a song when I first heard your podcast. I thought this sounded like something fun. I have a top four that had already all been done. So I started going through them and listening to ones and thought, okay, is it a song I really like? Does it really resonate me? Would it make a good discussion? And probably, I don't know, the second time I listened to this one, I thought, okay, there's a lot of meat there to talk about. And also going back to the quasi-terrible concert show in 1981, because he was doing the Shadows album, it had not yet come out, so the audience didn't know it. He did kind of explain a lot about the songs and maybe how they came into being. But the one I so distinctively remember him talking about this song that in the wake of the Iran hostage crisis, which was basically the impetus for it, he said he had been talking to some woman somewhere about politics. And she said, well, the devil is still alive in Iran.
And meaning the Ayatollah.
Exactly. Wherever along the spectrum you want to place it. But he said she said that and it just kind of woke him up. And he kind of went on a little talk about we're different countries, but, you know, we share the same continent. We share a border. He's always thought that, you know, Americans and Canadians were like brothers. And he says, I always like to say we were cut from the same cloth. And he specifically referenced the beginning of the whole Iranian hostage crisis that Canada helped get some of the diplomats out. There's a Ben Affleck movie that actually is about the Argo, about that situation. It's a little embellished, but it's a really good story. But he talked about that, you know, the pairing up the Americans and the Canadians, there's probably not another pair of countries in the world that would have tried to pull something like that off for each other.
Yeah, so, I figured that it was about that because it was composed around that time. Mm-hmm. And I'll talk about my own research about that in a second or two. So there is a certain affinity that Canada and the United States had during this time. And the hostages were American, of course. But Canada was certainly in sympathy, and the cooperation to get the diplomats out actually makes perfect sense. Is there a setting for you where this is the soundtrack of a certain activity or a certain time of day or a certain season for you? Or could you play this literally anywhere?
Of course, I would enjoy it anywhere, but I think this one needs to be heard in the mostly dark. Because I think it relates to the world and guiding principles of life and things like that. I think it's best kind of you focus inward. So to me, the ultimate environment would be in the dark. I mean, you know, maybe even kind of a cold, slightly rainy outdoors, just to add a little ambiance to it. Part of that might be that, you know, I first heard it in late November. And at the time, the weather, most of my activities outside of school were usually somewhat in the dark and just hearing this one to me, just, I want as much just in my mind. I want to cut off the rest of the world.
You living in the Pacific Northwest, I mean, that is the prevalent weather for much of the year, not all, but much of the year. Me, I would actually want to listen to it in the day, but I would want to listen to it while I'm up in the air, in a plane, maybe even parasailing over Lake Tahoe. Just looking out the window and seeing for miles and miles and miles and pondering how transcendent the song is in so many ways. I don't know that it's fair to call it an anthem, but it certainly is a transcendent song. And it's talking about evil and good in a way that you don't often hear from Lightfoot, who was not a particularly religious man. I have no doubt that he was a spiritual man, but certainly not a religious man in the traditional sense of the word.
Right. One note I had that kind of dovetails into that is I am in no way a religious person, but I've always felt that this song, maybe more of a literary work, is just the title in so few words evokes so much. And maybe we can get into this later, but just the whole concept of heaven, the expression itself, you know, heaven help, whatever, kind of means like you're going to get clobbered and need some kind of external divine help, and that we will be the ones invoking that upon what we see as someone who doesn't care for us or is out to harm us. But I think we're kind of right on the same page there. But that did remind me just that the title alone holds so much.
Yeah, and I've only thought of the title as being supremely ironic. Heaven help the devil. And
right.
Those two are so, the juxtaposition between those two entities could not be further. They're bent on destroying each other, or they're absolutely diametrically opposed to each other. So the title, just at a glance, is supremely ironic. But then when you get into the texture of the song, it has a whole lot more meaning to it. Well, that's all the time we have for Here in the Public Feed. If you'd like to hear the rest of this conversation, along with all of our other extended and bonus episodes, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or at fmpods.com. You can see the show notes for details.